CliffCentral.com.
Well, good morning, folks.
Auto Central, powered by
this
Auto Trader.
Is, Auto Central again on a Monday morning, and we have a semi-full studio. How's it, one-eared mic, dude? Whoa, let me turn them all on, because otherwise
hello,
they can't
hello.
Hear me.
Mic check. Hey, George, how are you?
All right, and you?
Good. I had a pretty chilled weekend, and then by the time Sunday came, I was, of course, the happiest man in the world. So,
well, that's one dealer, and he's happiest man in the world. It's on. I can hear you.
Oh.
How's it, Martin?
How's it, George?
Turn your volume up.
Oh, well, no, I can hear
it. It wasn't my fault.
Have a nice weekend, George.
Yeah, I know. Did you have a nice weekend?
Yeah, very relaxed. Some socializing for once.
For once?
Yeah.
What do you mean for once?
I'm a bit of a hermit.
Oh. Okay. What, do you sit and stare at your Land Rover?
Well, basically, yes. Of course, I'll throw it red-handed.
And Lawrence.
Hello.
How's it?
All good.
All good. Did you have a good weekend?
Why? What did you hear? Oh, no, I had a nice and spring cleany house maneuver.
Okay.
Got some sun. It was awesome.
Got some sun?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it was nice and sunny this weekend.
Yeah, I was kind of waiting for the giant rainstorm that they were predicting. And every time we saw a cloud, we were like, yeah, here it comes. And then
it's just more dust.
It just, it blew off to Centurion.
Well, let's get right into it, and let's get on to our first news story with our news segment, and that is 93 petrol worse or better than 95 octane fuel? And what is your take on this, Lawrence?
Well,
because, you know, I mean, the premise of this is that 93 is now significantly cheaper.
Okay, you don't get 93 at the coast. You get 95 and 97 at the coast, and up in Joburg you get 93 and 95. Now, as a general rule of thumb, I always put 95 in whatever car I'm driving.
Why?
Higher octane. Slightly, I wouldn't say negligible, but a slightly better performance. I would advise anybody who has a car that has a turbocharger, a minimum of 95.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't put 93 in a car that has a turbocharger. You will pick up problems.
Well, I mean, this comes off the back of the recent fuel price increases and fuel price fluctuations, which has now made 93 unleaded fuel 20 cents cheaper than 95 unleaded fuel. Obviously, this is only in the inland, as Lauren points out. But it starts to become quite lucrative or enticing to put in 93.
If you can afford it. Use 95. The higher octane is going to be better down the road for your car's health.
Why?
It burns easier.
I mean, isn't the only reason that we put higher octane fuel in is because of that knock effect?
Mm. Yeah, that's what I heard.
It's all down to the car's compression ratio and to the absence or presence of forced induction. So turbo or supercharged car, definitely 95. Mm. But to take your, for argument's sake, 2010 Kia Picanto 1100 and put 95 in there will be a complete waste.
So then why isn't there 93 in the coast?
It's got to do with the air pressure.
Yeah, air pressure. And
at sea level, the air pressure is much higher. Mm. So even cars that aren't necessarily prone to knock or detonation would be more prone to it down at sea level.
Down at the coast, because there's more oxygen versus fuel.
Well, and
so that mixture is different.
At the incident, the pressure actually goes up as well because of the increased ambient pressure.
That's why your car performs better down at the coast than what it does up here.
Yeah.
And why we always say that when you live up on the reef, you have to have a turbocharged car. Running NA is just...
But does 93, let's say I have a 2016 car and I use 93, is that really going to make a huge difference in terms of
over time,
performance?
Yes.
Depends on the car.
We know that there are certain automotive manufacturers that use direct injection.
Mm-hmm.
And over time of using a low quality fuel, you will get carbon buildup inside the cylinders and stuff. So using a higher octane fuel makes the engine run better.
It,
that's why race cars use 102.
Oh,
geez. Yeah.
Okay. So you can't get 102 octane out of a petrol.
Unless you can put F gas.
So here's
not unless you want to blow the car up.
So here's
some guys do.
Here's an actual easy rule. If your car is not turbocharged or supercharged,
use 93.
And you've been using 95 up till now. Put in 93 for two or three tanks and monitor your fuel consumption. Mm. You will, if the car would actually work better on 95, you will see a decrease in fuel consumption on the 95. But if it makes no difference, again.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the numbers. So if you've got a 50 liter fuel tank, for instance, and you use 93 unleaded fuel in the inland areas, you will save up to 21 rand for every refuel, which is about 1,000 rand per year. Now, I mean, 1,000 rand per year can take you out to dinner three or four times. So the saving doesn't seem
significant.
Mm. It doesn't seem significant. But if your car does require 95 fuel, which if it's turbocharged, rather use 95. But the savings don't seem like it's through the roof.
Yeah, and it's like for a while I used 93 because... Yeah, it was. Oh. It's there, but the last two or three years, I've been putting 95 in my car, and you can actually feel the performance difference between 95 octane and 93 octane.
Really,
the car is down on power. It might only be a few kilowatts, but it is noticeable when going up a hill or something. You can feel the performance difference.
I suppose, especially with your 1400 engines, naturally aspirated, it's going to be susceptible to fuel octane changes very quickly.
Yes. But then, of course, there is, I prefer performance.
Yeah.
And if you have a performance car, use the better fuel. It'll increase the life of your engine. And, yeah, it can actually, reduce the amount of services that you do as well. So,
interesting.
Anything to add, Martin?
I actually have a question there.
Yeah.
When you switched from 93 to 95 on your Hyundai, did it make a difference in the fuel consumption?
Yes.
Better on 95.
Better on 95.
Yes. 93, average.
More or less?
9.8 to 10 liters per 100 in urban.
Yeah.
So that's the school run coming to the office.
Is that on 93?
Yeah,
93. Yeah.
Now, 95, anywhere between 7.5 and 8.1.
So it's
a big difference, especially when I'm doing like 85 to 90 kilometers round trip.
That's about a 20 to 25% difference.
Yes.
In fuel consumption. So yeah, we got 20 cents fuel price difference between 93 and 95, and it's just
if you can afford it, go 95.
No,
you
absolutely.
Can't lose.
So it goes further, 15 rand 79 versus 16 rand 21, and so 20 cents is really minuscule compared to the actual fuel price per liter, and maybe using 95 is actually more fuel efficient, which means that you'll save money using 95 rather than trying to save money using 93. That's kind of like what you're saying.
Yeah, pretty much.
And you've experienced this.
Yes,
on your car.
Yes,
which is what you were, which is what you were saying.
What I was saying just now. Fill up with 93 for a few tanks if your car can accommodate it at all, and monitor your fuel consumption.
The owner's manual will tell you as well. If you're not sure about this, pull out your owner's manual, and it'll tell you what's the minimum grade octane that you can use in your car safely.
Or if it's a German car, it'll say always use the highest possible available octane.
So if there's 106 Avgas, I'm putting that in. Well, I'm going to get a bottle of octane booster and
go to the moon. In my aircraft, which uses 95 octane fuel, the recommendation is that you put Avgas in every now and again, and that is to clean the carbon out.
Yeah.
Because the carbon buildup, because of lower octane fuel, is present inside the valve lifters, and
you can't run a normal car engine on F-gas, a clean F-gas.
Yeah.
It has to be mixed down because it will explode.
No, come on, it's just high octane petrol.
Yeah, and then you get.
Can you run any vehicle?
The opposite of a knock, an explosion.
The actual problem with F-gas in a pit in a road car is F-gas has no lubricant added to the fuel mix.
No additives.
Hence the explosion.
Right. But that's how it cleans out the carbon. Because
throw half a bottle of acetone in the petrol tank.
Okay.
Some mothballs.
Mothballs. Here we go. Back to 1984. Mothballs. When last have I heard about mothballs in a fuel tank? That sounds like pure and cool.
The Roadhouse.
I don't know about the Roadhouse, but I know when I was growing up, Pure and Cool. Is Pure and Cool still going?
I don't think so.
You don't think so? It was shut down by the police, I think.
We're giving away too much.
I don't have a clue, but mothballs in your fuel tank just sounds like the days of 1984. Moving swiftly along, what's wrong with my freaking speech today? Reynolds SA now offering a year's insurance on the Clio Sandero, which is very interesting because insurance for all of us is a grudge purchase, right? I mean, we don't want to pay it. You get insurance calls and usually we go to the lowest bidder. And that's what my experience has been. It's like, okay, if you can offer me these services, I want to pay as little as possible. I don't really care about too many of the other, you know, little benefits. Like, I'm not interested in loyalty programs with insurance companies. What do you guys think?
Your insurance is there on a finance vehicle to protect the bank's investment.
Is that your take?
Yes.
Okay. What about your investment?
Yeah.
Well, if you don't own the car, the bank does. And a lot of people
The case of houses too, right?
Yeah. Mm. The car is not yours until the final payment is made, and then you can decide to switch your insurance.
Well, let's just give some clarity to that. When you do finance a car, you get the ownership right, so you get the papers for, you know, your name's on the papers for ownership, but the title papers actually sit at the bank.
Yeah.
A few people are aware of this. Those papers actually sit at the bank. You don't have possession of those title papers, and the bank at any time if you default on that payment can take the car.
Exactly.
Because they have title. They have legal title to the car. So so Lawrence is absolutely right.
And, you know, they're protecting the investment. You are required by law to have insurance on a financed vehicle. Mm. If you don't and you crash that car, they can take you to court and they can take you for everything you own.
Or they'll just let you
keep
on paying it until the terms of the finance agreement is expired.
Yeah. So my thing is have insurance.
Yeah, no, for sure.
It doesn't matter what insurance you have, just have something.
It's also not just about you.
It's about everybody else around you.
It's about anyone else involved in an accident. Let's say your car bursts a tire and goes out of control on the freeway and you crash into a 1.5 million rand Land Cruiser.
Yeah.
Which will cost about 200,000 to fix. If you don't have insurance,
you're going to be broke forever.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, so this story kind of reminds me of something I've read with these OEMs sort of giving extra value to consumers. It goes with, I think last week we did that story on Audi extending the motor plan to 10 years.
Well, no, that came out last week.
Yeah.
It's actually hand in hand with this. It seems like all the motor manufacturers are sort of climbing on this bandwagon and offering extended warranties, extended motor plans, these insurance things. I mean, Renault was the first one to offer years with him insurance on the Quid.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've extended that to the Clio and the Sandero. So big ups to them. If you know, they're basically just helping people be prepared.
I think the first time I heard of this kind of scheme was Mitsubishi with a little, what's that stupid Mirage?
Mm.
That little hatchback.
That existed?
Thingamagody. Yeah.
To
entice people to buy this thing, they actually said, yeah, buy it and we'll give you 2 years free insurance.
Yeah.
Well, the insurance also comes with the ability for the insurance company to track driving behavior.
Now, see, now there I have a problem. I don't want Big Brother looking over my shoulder while
so
I'm
I wonder
doing
if you, when you're
parking,
if you're driving and the phone rings, like, slow down.
George, you laugh. That is actually the case. You can. I think Discovery has the thing now where they actually drive a DNA. Mm. They know the profile of the person that's behind the wheel because everybody has a fingerprint. Yeah, everybody has a particular way that they drive. And they can tell when the person who's supposed to be driving the car isn't
driving the car.
Now, I have a tracker that also has a whole bunch of other stuff attached to it that you can basically set up in the back end of the app. The car crosses a certain city boundary. It sends messages. I mean, this is just tied in with. It worries me a little that you have. That
but it drops
much
your premium, doesn't it? If you do drive
significantly.
Yeah.
Well, I think I saved about 650 rand a month by fitting that device.
Well, you see, Lawrence, he's onto the saving on 95-octane fuel, onto the saving of insurance and driving.
Any little bit that
listen
saves
to
me
Lawrence,
money.
650 rand is not something to sneeze at. So well done. On to the next story. Tesla's auto parking fail could lead to a legal fight. So here's an interesting thing. Recently, Tesla released this software update to their cars where you can summon the car from your garage. I think you've been able to do this for a while, but what you have to do is on the app, within line of sight, and I think it's within 60 meters or something, or 60 feet, 60 meters, that you have to hold the button down, and then you can summon the car to you.
And then it drives over you.
And then it drives over you.
Only so if it's a Mustang.
Oh, my goodness.
Mustangs don't have autonomous driving yet. When they do, we should all be worried. So now, Skynet has been active.
So what's the part? What's the point of this feature? Is it just like if you're in a tight spot? Like what's the?
Well, I suppose if you're standing on the sidewalk and your car's down there in the parking lot somewhere, you can summon the car to come to you instead of you going to the car, which I think is an interesting feature. But the question is, what happens if the car bumps something? Well, who pays for that insurance? Who's at fault? For lack of a better question,
I don't think there is any proven thing that they can sort of test this against. There's no proven test case.
There's no precedent. Yeah,
there's no precedent. I think once we get into a period in motoring where we have proper autonomous driving, then the insurance companies are going to have to sit down and have a cup of tea with the auto manufacturers and say, okay, well, listen, if your car is driving itself and it drives over an old lady who was walking across the road, who's responsible?
Well,
sort of,
I mean,
hand in hand with the next story, you know, that I don't know. I can't really say because there is no precedent for it. We don't know. And we can't point fingers until something actually happens and then they have sort of legislation for it.
Well, the US regulators are looking into, you know, recent parking lot crashes involving Tesla cars driving themselves to their owners. And this is interesting because there's been a couple of YouTube videos of one in particular, a Tesla scraping the side of a door when the owner summoned the car out of the garage. If you watch the YouTube video, you'll see that the car just turns sharply to the left, and then the side gets scraped against the garage door, which is very interesting. What made the car do that? When you're holding that button, do you control the direction the car's going in, or does the car control it?
Well, if it's anything like BMW system, you have a remote that has a forward and reverse.
Mm.
You cannot steer the car with the remote.
Does the car steer itself?
The car steers itself. Ah. It uses an array of sensors and radar and the stuff that they usually use for the automatic city park and parallel parking systems that they have. That is what they use to drive the car out.
So Tesla says that you are still responsible. That's why they've got this feature where you have to hold the button down. And you have to be in line of sight of the car because you have to be able to release that. When you release the button, the car stops. So they say that you're still responsible for your car and must monitor it and its surroundings at all times within your line of sight because it may not detect all obstacles. And in this case, the side of a garage.
Just the wall.
Which is, you know, it's the issue that I have with adaptive cruise control and the radar. What happens if something splashes on that radar and
hit the brakes
and fuzzies the signal? You know, then your adaptive cruise control doesn't work, and you're going to slam into the guy in front of you at 120 k's an hour.
And you'd think that might be funny, but it actually isn't. It's beautiful Volvo that George saw outside just now as well. It has possibly one of the best mass market autonomous feature sets. And yet, it still tried to park on top of a Mazda Sting on Saturday.
Yeah.
What? Tell us more.
Yep.
We'll
try to
there.
Park on.
I had the car. I wanted to demonstrate to my passenger the car's self-parking ability.
And that never.
It's funny
goes
how it
well.
Always goes Hold wrong my, when yeah. you do
Watch
a demo.
This.
And there was a dark grey Mazda Sting parked in line. Just in front of the parking spot where I wanted to go. And the next moment, this Volvo just started turning its steering wheel. And I slammed on the brakes with this car heading straight for this Mazda's rear end.
And the brakes worked.
No. Well, the brakes
worked. That's why I don't trust computers yet.
Yeah.
You don't trust computers.
I don't trust computers yet.
I hover with my foot over the brake pedal. I could be doing 120 on the freeway, adaptive cruise control's working. I start coming up towards that car in front of me and my foot's hovering over the brake pedal.
So your right leg is bigger than your left leg, yes?
I'm waiting for it to fail and I'm going to be there to pick up the business.
That's kind of my point here. I mean, Volvo has one of the most advanced autonomous or semi-autonomous suites out there. And if their cars can still make that kind of mistake.
That just shows you that these mistakes can happen. Well, a Model 3 In the US, obviously, a driverless Tesla Model 3 was pulled over by police for failure to stop, right? The funny thing about this story was that there was no one in the car when the policeman stopped the car. Now, it's, I mean, the stories are doing the rounds that this was a staged thing and that the video isn't real and that the cop was in on it. But, you know, this guy was summoning his car and put it in autonomous mode, and then the cop stopped the car, but there was no one in the driver's seat.
So if you get a ticket in this case, who gets the ticket?
Well, that's the whole question, right? I mean, whether this is a real or staged video, what happens? I would imagine the person that summoned the car, yeah, the person that's in control of the car, no matter where they are, it's like a drone. If you're in control of the drone, the fact that you're not sitting on the drone doesn't make you not responsible. So I would imagine that it will go down to who was in control of that car at that time, no matter whether they're in it or not. I mean, what are your thoughts?
I agree.
Yeah, 100%.
You are responsible for the car, even if you just gave it the command to come to you. You're still responsible because you pressed the button.
Exactly. So that leads us to our next story, which is the CEO of Nissan. Well, there's been a change in the CEO of Nissan.
Yeah, because the other guy's in jail.
Well, you've got to have someone in the seat, I suppose, eh? So Nissan named Senior Vice President Makoto Yoshida as its next chief executive on Tuesday, picking a relative outsider who joined the carmaker mid-career and is known for his rigorous work ethic and relentless focus on cost control. Oh, yeah. What do you think is going to happen to Nissan?
Oh, well.
Because they're calling him a dark horse. Why a dark horse?
Nissan needs to. They're in bed with. They're part of the alliance.
Renault.
So they are going to be pretty much doing what the rest of the alliance does. It's. I don't think they're going to just suddenly pull off and go back to being one of the largest Japanese automakers in the world.
Yeah, the thing that worries me there is that phrase, relentless focus on cost control.
Because that usually means, what do you do here? Well, I bolt these things. Okay, you're fired.
And so are these things that you're bolting on the car. And that's how you end up with, for instance, the fall of General Motors in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, the fall of General Motors 2 years ago.
Or 10 years ago. Or
every other year.
You were going to say when the accountants? I'm assuming a controversial soundbite's coming.
When the accountants take over at a car company, there are inevitable drops in vehicle quality. The same thing happened with Mercedes-Benz in the 90s.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that when that word cost control or cost cutting starts to be bantered around, it means that quality drops at the same time.
So there's going to be layoffs. There's going to be a cut in the quality of the materials. They'll stop using leather and start using plastic.
Possibly, we don't know that yet.
For the most part,
going on history, going on lessons from history. That's exactly what's going to happen.
And variants of the premium vehicles are also going to start disappearing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, to infinity and beyond. The next story is about a South African, and he calls his car the Roadrunner. And this Isuzu KB Bucky has done 1.7 million kilometers. An Otsuen retiree with a Bucky that's done 1.7 million kilometers. And in my mind, this is quite an achievement. And much like he says, reaching your diamond year or 60th year or platinum year or 17th year in wedding anniversary, he says he speaks to his car every single day and asks it nicely. That he needs to rely on it and to get him where he needs to go. And
see, now this is what happens when you live in the middle of nowhere.
He talks to his car. Yeah. Well, they say you should talk to plants.
Hang on a second, right there. I mean, I talk to my Land Rover. So what does this tell me about British?
Your Land Rover is parked in your garage with a giant oil span underneath it. So you're obviously not saying nice things.
well,
testament to the fact that they built things right back in the 70s, and what the wonders of proper routine maintenance.
Yeah. Well, this gentleman by the name of Gerard de Toy, go and look him up. He's been doing about 300 kilometers a day in the Roadrunner and travels to make and makes the Bucky a true workhorse. He stops and starts the Bucky about 80 to 100 times a day. So don't think that this Bucky has done 1.7 million kilometers, and it's all been highway driving. He's got a courier business. So after he retired, he started a courier business. And then, you know, he drives to go and drop off parcels to his various customers. And in so doing, has done 1.7 million kilometers. And he bought the car secondhand when it had about 7,000 kilometers on the clock in 1997.
Yeah. 15 years he's been driving this car.
15 years he's been driving this car. 1.7 million kilometers. And then another story. Toyota pumps another 450 million rand into the local Hi-Ace assembly plant. Now, this is brilliant because, you know, we all know that the automotive industry contributes about 7% to our GDP in total. And Toyota has invested over 1 billion rand into South African assembly plants in the last couple of years. And I think that this is a brilliant move and some build some confidence in the future of the country.
Well, when you look at what is the largest fleet of vehicles in South Africa?
Well, in taxis. Africa.
It's Toyota. Taxis. Yeah. It's taxis. Yeah. And, well, the Hi-Ace is, it's been the taxi of choice for decades.
Yes, yeah.
Well, the minibus taxi industry is worth about 50 billion rand a year, believe it or not.
Oh, jeez.
And the minibus taxis represent about 75% of all transport to work, school, and university, illustrating how important a driver is to the local economy.
Yeah, so I can sort of, it's a no-brainer to invest in that, keep it going, and hopefully make the vehicles out there safer by... just that recapitulation thing they tried a few years back. Just take the old cruddy ones off the road
and put new ones on. Exactly. Mm. Well, Toyota says that Hi-Ace controls about 96% of the market share, an increase from 77% in 2015.
Yep.
So, so who knows? Maybe, maybe we'll see better quality taxis on the road as a result of this half a billion rand worth of investment.
I mean, you saw what happened when they tried the recapitalization scheme. A lot of the old Stallion Hi-Ace has disappeared and replaced with Quantums. So there was an uptake there, and we did see a lot of the old rust buckets disappearing and new
Quantums
safe vehicles coming in. And then that whole thing sort of just died down.
Yeah.
And we're seeing the rise of the scrapper come back again. So
the rise of the scrapper?
Yeah, the taxi that's being driven with a pair of gas pliers, you know?
Yeah.
The door falls off. You know, that's why they drive with their arm out the window.
The rise of the scrapper.
Yeah, they drive with their arm out the window to keep the door on.
Isn't it called the Skorogoro or something?
Skorogoro.
You see, it wasn't that bad. Skorogoro. That's when the thing is falling apart. You're using a vice grip to turn the whatever you can find. The thing's tied together by duct tape.
Until the wheels fall off.
The driver and the door.
That's Skorogoro.
I think it's a good move on Toyota's part. Invest in the industry. Make it safer, as safe as it can be.
And the government's on board as well, which is good.
No, this is brilliant. I mean, half a billion rand worth of investment into something that contributes 7% to our GDP, which gets us into our Auto Talk segment. And today we have Martin reviewing the new Range Rover Evoque.
Yep. Okay, there we go. You might look
at
this.
You lose your
thing.
Place.
Yeah. I couldn't find the right tab, actually. So, one dealer asked me on, what was it, Friday morning, but is this a new Evoque? And that's actually a question I received a couple of times, because it looks so much like the old one.
The cracker is, though, when you park it next to the old one, boom, you can see the differences immediately.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I was on the launch of the vehicle, and on the night of the launch, I sat there and I was like, so what's new about it? And then they actually pulled the two of them into the showroom together, and then you can see, okay, that's different, that's different, that's different, that's different.
Well, subtle changes.
Well, I mean, I've always liked the Range Rover Evoque. It's been a car that... I mean, the whole Range Rover series is a nice car for me. It's just that they're sexy looking cars.
You know what got me about the Evoque was it looks soft and squishy like a city car. And then when you actually take it off-road, you realize...
It's far more competent than you think.
Holy cow, this thing is a proper off-road vehicle.
It actually only has one problem. You see, when the Evoque first came out, it had, from the Land Rover conglomerate, it had one opponent from within, and that was the Discovery, well, the Freelander 2, actually, at that stage, with which it shares the mechanicals. So the Evoque was like the sexier, slinkier sister car to the Discovery 2. But now there's, to the Freelander 2.
Yeah.
Now there's the Discovery Sport, which looks very much like the Evoque, only not quite as slinky. And you have the Jaguar E-Pace, which is, again, essentially the same thing.
Same platform. Yeah. Same electronics, same machinery, same fittings inside.
And I'm going to be honest with you. Yes, it looks like a Land Rover. And when you touch the squishy bits inside, it's a Range Rover. It looks like a Range Rover, and well,
what's the fundamental difference between a Land Rover and a Range Rover? I mean, by and large.
Well, the Range Rover is the more upmarket one.
It's the executive.
Okay, but what things do you see inside the Range Rover that
nowadays
that are not in the Land Rover?
Not much.
Not much.
In the old days, the Land Rover was the square, boxy, aluminium-bodied. Yes. Farmhorse, where the Range Rover was.
Farmhorse.
And then the Discovery came around, which kind of filled the gap between the Farmhorse and the soft Range Rover.
Yeah.
But now they have stacked in so many lifestyle SUVs into their range that I don't actually know if there really is a place for the Evoque.
And Evoque's not old. I mean, it's not been in the market for too long.
8 years?
Yeah. 8 years, that's not long.
It was around,
but it's done well. I think there definitely is.
I mean, when it first came out, I thought it was a ladies' car.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. You know, it's just most, you saw most women buying the car from what I could perceive.
Well, one of the biggest marketing drives was the fact that it was partly designed or assisted by Victoria Beckham. Blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Okay, so how did this car perform, and what does it cost?
I actually liked it very much, except for two things. The one I had on test was the D180. So that was the lowest output diesel version.
Yeah.
In so-called S trim. So that's one step up from entry level. And if you look at it from the outside, it actually looks beautiful in this almost base spec decoration. You don't need all the extra stripes and add on plastic bits to make it look good.
Sticker pack is
exactly.
Martin,
so it's a nice clean design. But that D180 engine doesn't perform the way you'd expect a car of this price class or of this with this price tag to perform. Mm.
Is it turbocharged?
Turbocharged 2-liter diesel, and the figures look okay. 132 kilowatts and 430 newton meters. The problem is the car weighs 1.8 tons, and that's not enough.
Has it got an electric car battery?
No.
Why is it so heavy?
That's a very good question.
Hmm.
It's a heavy platform to start off with.
Yeah.
And it's not as economical as it should be.
So you think it's the power to weight?
I think it's the power to weight. There isn't enough power to drag along this heavy body. To put it quite bluntly, once you're up and running on the freeway, it's fine because there you have that nice wedge of torque. But
when you're cruising around Sandton in rush hour traffic
and you stop start, it becomes a bit frustrating.
11.8.
And now the problem is, for $6,000 less than this D180S, you can get a P250, which is the entry level petrol,
much better,
which has a lot more power. Okay, it doesn't have the 10-way electric seats, and it doesn't have leather upholstery. And that's all it really loses out on.
Did you have the rear view camera thing in the rear view mirror?
No, this one had it on the infotainment display.
Okay, now, because the one we tested, when you put the car into reverse, the rear view mirror turns into a screen, and it shows you what's behind the car. It also had a 360-degree panoramic camera, but it had cameras underneath the car. So when you switch it on the infotainment and you're driving over the rocks, it actually shows you the two front wheels and then exactly what is underneath the car.
But that's the technology we spoke about one or two shows ago.
Yes. Mm. Now, of course, the one that Martin tested, which is the entry-level one, didn't have all these nice little gizmos and everything. So how much did it cost?
788,000 rand before any of these options.
It's a lot of money for a toy.
A lot of money. Yeah. And like I said, for 6 grand less, you can buy a base trim, which essentially just loses the leather seats and the electric adjustment for the seats. But you get a lot more power. And the thing is, this diesel was not fuel efficient enough. Nowhere near fuel efficient enough. I mean, I returned an average figure of 9.1 liters per 100.
That's not bad.
So this is essentially one of those big Louis Vuitton handbags.
Yes.
Completely useless, but everybody wants one.
Exactly.
Is it going to lose the roof again?
Huh?
Because the previous one, you could get a convertible version.
Oh,
of the
no.
Which was as ugly as
I don't think they'll do that again.
And no, I'm still stuck at the Louis Vuitton bag.
Well, George, if you look at the...
It's a fashion accessory with wheels.
If you look at my review title, it says...
Well, I see you gave it a 3.5 out of 5.
Yeah, boutique hiking gear, now in this year's colors. And that actually ties in perfectly with Lawrence's observation there as well.
But the only downside here is the underpowered nature of the car. The rest you seem to be happy with.
I really like the rest of the car, especially in S form, believe it or not, or in close to baseline spec, because it has the smaller wheels, so it has nice and tall tire sidewalls. There's no sporting pretenses to this thing, so it actually rides really nicely.
Yeah, so it's good for off-road.
But it's got Land Rover's suspension.
Well, you'd be amazed at how harshly these cars can ride when you start running up to the 20 or 22-inch wheels.
Ah, okay.
So this one, in terms of those things, actually struck the perfect balance. But I would skip the S add-ons, and I'd rather go for a petrol, which is probably going to be just as thirsty, but at least you'll have some power.
9 liters per 100 is not bad, eh?
It's not terrible.
Which sort of tells you what Land Rover, Range Rover owners are thinking. I mean, they 2 weeks ago they launched the new Defender.
Yeah.
And it looks like an Evoque. It has the same styling features.
Mm.
Yeah.
But then they offer you things like steel wheels. Because they know the guys are going to take them off road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
not available with this. So yeah, this is, and that's why I gave this particular test car a 3.5 out of 5.
I mean, 7 out of 10 is still a good score. It's not a bad score. I mean, the way you were talking, I would have thought like 5 out of 10 would have been the score.
Well,
but
apart from the lack of performance and the rather disparate fuel thirst, it's actually a very nice car. So in this particular configuration, it's not the optimal combination.
Yeah.
I think if you shop a little bit more carefully, you can actually get a really nice vehicle at similar for similar money, or just buy a pre-owned one with all the toys and a petrol engine.
Hmm.
Or you could just look for a Velo.
Which is more expensive, another 300,000 more expensive.
Well, there you're going to go over a million.
A second-hand Velo.
You're going to go way over a million rand with that. Well,
this Range Rover Evoque was a bit of a mixed emotion car for me. There were bits of it that I really liked, but some important bits really let me down.
Well, that takes us straight into our industry talk segment, and we are first talking about trade wars. Now, have you been following what Donald Trump's been doing to the world?
Yeah, he's pissing off China.
He's pissing off everyone.
Yeah, I'm mad.
I understand what the man's trying to do. He's just going about it the completely wrong way.
Well, the word on the street is that this trade war that America has started could cost the global car industry 11.6 trillion rand. Or 700 billion euros.
That is a number that is so big you can't even conceptualize it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I understand what, like I said, he's trying to create work back home.
Yeah.
So to do that, we're going to impose tariffs on stuff that is coming into the country.
No, I mean, let me give you my perspective on that bit. I don't, you know, Donald Trump, good guy, bad guy, it's irrelevant. You know, I think what he's trying to do is trying to look after America.
Yeah.
That's what he's trying to do. He's just trying to look after America. You know, whether that's good or whether that's bad for America or for the rest of the world, I mean, it remains to be seen, because the moves he's making are drastic. Yeah. But as a result of what he's doing, this 11.6 trillion rand sales over the next 7 years is a pending reality.
Mm.
And that's the horror. Unless it's made in America, you're going to pay tax on bringing it in. And there are so many auto manufacturers that do not have manufacturing facilities in the States. Yeah. So the cars are imported from Mexico, from Brazil,
from Canada,
South Africa, because the Raptor goes there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if Ford America wants to bring in Raptors from South Africa, they have to pay
import tax. Well, I mean, I think what's interesting here is that, you know, we're all around the world saying, "Oh, the car industry is in trouble."
It's just adding.
But it seems to be. I mean, what do you think that this could be the main reason for the drop in sales worldwide, rather than it being, you know, everything else?
I had an interesting chat with a senior executive at Mercedes-Benz last week on this very topic. And he says that they are now planning to move their SUV assembly facilities from America to either China or India or either or even Eastern Europe. Because the cars they built, the SUVs they built in America, still have a lot of imported components, and if they have to pay these import trade tariffs on these things, it just won't be worthwhile for them to build the cars there anymore, because the American market is there, but it's not the main market anymore. It's not their main focus. And what Donald Trump is losing sight of is the global economy looks completely different to what it did in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. No, it definitely did. I mean, to put some perspective to the unit numbers, this 700 billion euros or 11 trillion rand over the next couple of years is about 35 million units that won't flow because of this trade war, which is a hell of a lot of wheels. But what will happen? I mean, you can't tell me that those 35 million units are not going to be manufactured.
Someone else is going to manufacture
them. And I'm sure that America's hoping that that happens inside the country.
Mm. The problem is these 35 million units, only about 10 million of them, I'd guess, are local in America. The rest are all overseas. Cars built in America, but from imported components, which now can't be exported anymore because the cars become too expensive to build in America.
So does a U.S. citizen then have to pay more for, for instance, a vehicle?
See, and that's what makes everybody sort of sit down and go, what are you doing?
It's a double-edged sword,
you're saying, okay, we don't want goods made in China here, but you're penalizing the local businesses that are importing the stuff. You're not penalizing the country of origin. You're penalizing the people that are purchasing it.
And you're penalizing the local business, the American business, who tries to export these things to China, which is still...
Because they're saying, okay, well, if you're not going to buy our stuff, we're not going to buy yours.
Well, exactly. I mean, doesn't this go against this whole global economy and the reason the internet exists is to create one planet rather than lots of countries?
And that is why everybody's off with the man, because we understand what he's trying to do and it's admirable, but you're going about it the wrong way.
I think I like what you said earlier on. We're not in the 1950s.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have the internet. Everything is transparent. We have a global economy. Yeah. So
everybody needs to work together if we're going to get anywhere. Because if
because people like a Chinese vehicle doesn't make that bad.
No.
Yeah. No.
And if it's cheaper to manufacture the vehicle there, well, so...
I think some American vehicles are pretty damn good looking. Mm. Some of the stuff that Toyota sells in the States that the rest of the world doesn't get, I think, are very, very nice. Mm-hmm.
It remains to be seen. Let's see what this trade war yields in the future. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe America is going to become an island.
Yeah, well, it kind of fits with a lot of his rhetoric. When I listen to Donald Trump speak, it's like the man is still stuck in the 1950s and he doesn't understand how the world has changed.
Read the man's Twitter account.
Yes.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Well, closer
back to the future. 88 miles an hour in the DeLorean. There we go.
The DeLorean. And the DeLorean didn't even come from America. Something closer to home. The SA automotive industry is threatened by the shift to EVs. So this global shift towards electric mobility is creating significant challenges for South Africa and our automotive industry, which accounts for about 7% of our GDP, as we said. 30% of the country's entire manufacturing output and 14% of total exports. Because, as we've said a number of times before, we have assembly plants. We don't have designers and manufacturers in South Africa. We don't design these cars. So we are going to be forced to shift to electric vehicles at some point.
And that's the thing is, the date hasn't been set yet.
But what date?
The date to
shift
of,
EV.
Of shift.
I don't think there's a date. I think there's a...
It hasn't been set yet, but the rest of the world is taking steps to set it. By 2020, by 2025, by 2030. And unless South Africa gets on the bus now, they're going to be left standing in short trousers when that date does get set.
And that's why I get extremely upset when I read this kind of thing, because South Africa in 2011, you will know about this, George, we had the Juul EV, which was crash tested, ready for export to Europe. Ready for production, they just needed that final gas injection to set up the factory. South Africa could have been a world leader in the way in that EVs. Tesla is.
Exactly. Well, and it kind of is, because Elon Musk comes from here.
Yeah, except he disowns the country.
Yeah, he does. So, you know, the entire value chain of the South African automotive industry employs around 500,000 people. And EVs still average about 2 to 4% of sales in most markets, but more than 400 different EV models are forecast to be in our market by 2020, driven largely by government vehicle emission policies. Now, you can have a vehicle emission policy. That's fine. But if the import tax or if we don't drop import taxes on electric vehicles, number one, or number two, we get don't start assembling electric vehicles in the country, that little emissions policy is going to mean little.
Absolutely. Well, not only that, when you consider that so many overseas markets are moving over to EVs and the vast majority of cars produced in South Africa are exported. That does not bode well for our local assembly slash exporting business.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's exactly what's going to happen, because we export so many vehicles. By the time the European, Chinese, and Indian markets that we export to switch to EVs, we're going to be sat on our hands.
Yeah.
Because we're only producing ICE vehicles. So when are we going to start producing EVs? I'm pretty sure the manufacturers are thinking about this, but it is an important step, I think, to changing our own country's path to electric vehicles.
Yeah, well, without decisive government action on this matter, we will fall behind, and we are already falling behind.
So let's see. You know, the Automobile Manufacturers Association is targeting to produce 1.4 million vehicles annually by 2035, but how many of those are going to be electric vehicles, and how many of them are going to be traditional ICE vehicles? I don't know. The jury's out. Let's see what happens to electric vehicles in the future. What do you think is going to happen to the electric vehicle market? Do you think the import taxes are going to drop? Do you think we're going to be forced at a late stage to adopt electric vehicles?
I think unless they pull their fingers out their butts, we're going to be literally at that crest where the rest of the world has made the decision and we're still sitting there going, okay, well, we don't really know what's happening. So
I'm a bit hopeful because these talks are happening. It's not like we're not doing anything.
You know, we had the Smart Mobility Summit last week, and we actually had a couple of politicians, really important ones, drive electric cars. There was a massive convoy that drove across the country, stopped at different charging points. All the manufacturers that had electric cars brought some in, and they drove this convoy of electric vehicles across the country to sort of push the idea.
Yeah.
And I did see an image of Lesufi behind the wheel of one.
Yeah.
With a tagline of no vrpa, just
vrpa.
No vrpa, just
Well, I suppose it remains to be seen. I mean, my perspective is that, you know, if we don't, I mean, infrastructure is already there and it's gaining momentum. Just my question are, where are the cars? And that comes down to import tax reductions and local assembly, which, as Wandile says, the manufacturers are really talking about. But let's watch this one very closely, because if it doesn't happen fast enough, if we don't get the cars on the road, the end result is an aging ICE vehicle fleet in the country. Cars getting older and older and older because we just can't get our hands on ICE vehicles anymore, or we continue to assemble them in South Africa until they age beyond the point of recovery, and then we hit that steep curve of adoption of electric vehicles, which is then painful for everybody. But that takes us straight into our Grid Talk segment, and we have our very own resident Wandile Sishe, who was excited by yesterday's race, and so was I.
I was, yeah. Honestly, finally, 2019 now has a champion in terms of constructor, and we know now that the driver champion is also going to be from Mercedes. So first, I just want to say congratulations.
How do you know that?
Well, because there's nothing else anybody else can do.
Well, we spoke about this briefly the last show, yeah. And I actually watched a very, very interesting video about when is it mathematically impossible.
It's not.
Or at what point is it mathematically possible for somebody to win the championship? And that is race 11 is the earliest somebody can...
Have it in the bag. Yeah.
And then they were talking Suzuka is probably the... earliest that you can wrap up the construction, which is exactly what happened. So Merck has got the constructors. They cannot finish the rest of the races for the season and they will still win.
Yeah, no, they've got the constructors, but the driver championship.
But nobody else can catch the
points deficit is now so high that it is either going to be Bottas or Hamilton. Because Bottas is the only person who can still challenge Hamilton points-wise for the championship.
Yeah. But I think what's encouraging for me is that the last couple of races have been absolutely epic. It's been proper
drama.
It's the Formula One we were all hoping for.
Yeah. If that had happened from the beginning of the year, I don't think Hamilton?
Definitely not. No.
Hamilton or Bottas would have been as far ahead as they are. And another thing I've noticed is in the Ferrari camp, I don't know what your take on this is, Wandile, but the thing I've noticed in the Ferrari camp is that Vettel last year was an incredibly emotional character.
Yeah.
How he won four world championships, I mean, he must have just had a good car because his head is not where Hamilton's head is.
Yeah.
And then I switched tack and I thought, well, Leclerc is now my new driver of choice in the Ferrari camp because he's got his head screwed on right. But that's been undone in the last couple of races. Mm. He's really showed his emotional side with his head not being in the game and really getting frustrated for what, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, you can't get frustrated if you're not fast enough. It's not everyone else's fault. It's your fault. But the thing that I've noticed is that the last 2 to 3 races, Vettel
has come to the party
mentally come to the party. I mean,
he switched on the Iceman.
Yeah, you see, here's the thing, right? I think Ferrari were in trouble. The last 5 years, they had some difficulties and they had some problems with the car. After winter break, they now have a track weapon, something that nobody else can touch in one lap.
A track weapon, I like that.
And Vettel has really sort of, I think, let's give him a lot of kudos for actually prepping Leclerc as well. I think a lot of Leclerc's success in the last 4 races has got to do with how the team has worked around getting the car ready for him.
Well, I think a lot of Leclerc's win is because of Vettel's head not being in the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's been quicker. I mean, he's been quicker, so we can't take anything away from
him. Take anything away from it. He has been quicker, but Vettel's been quicker than him in the last two sessions.
Yeah. But just to round up what happened this week, so qualifiers had to move to Sunday because of the typhoon. Essentially, it was a 3-horse race. It was one horse and two Mercedes, really, with Bottas essentially taking over Vettel in the first turn because of a jump start, and the race pretty much stayed that way the whole way around. And then Hamilton was chasing Vettel, which was just great to see a 4-time and a 5-time world champion sort of battle it out.
Yeah,
and Hamilton he couldn't answer what Ferrari had thrown at him, so that was great to see as well. But once again, I was telling you, George, earlier that Alex Albon in the Red Bull, I think, well done to him.
Well, you know, I said for a while, I don't know whether Ricciardo should have moved and you know, my wife will not agree with me. Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know if Ricciardo should have moved from definitely from Red Bull. But Albon is starting to bring himself to the party.
Yeah, I mean, he did the same time as Max in qualifiers, or I think it was FP2.
And there's a poor little guy which has just had a run of bad luck.
Yeah.
Oh, Verstappen. Started so well.
Oh,
started so well and has now ended down nowhere.
Not his fault, though. Both of his crashes this year have been people crashing into him. So I think he's been unlucky this year. It's unfortunate what's happened to him, but I'm sure next year it's going to be just, yeah, everyone's going to have their deuces up.
Their what is up?
Deuces.
The deuces.
Yeah.
The deuces up. Well, let's talk about Ricciardo for a second. There's been rumors that he's going to move to Ferrari in 2020. And
what, is a test driver?
Maybe he's already a test
driver.
That's
where old drivers go.
But he's absolutely flat out denied that in the press, saying that he's got a fixed contract and that even if the performance was up there, he wouldn't be going to Ferrari. Now, who would he replace, Leclerc or Vettel, if this was the case?
Probably Vettel.
Probably Vettel.
Yeah.
Well, what if Vettel begins to win in 2020?
Well, then probably resumes winning.
I think he's going to go to Mercedes then, to be honest.
You think Vettel's going to go to Mercedes?
No, I think Daniel would have to go to Mercedes.
My wife will be very happy if Daniel Ricciardo goes to Mercedes and begins winning races. I think he's capable of winning races. Yeah, I really think he's capable of winning races. But, you know, he has to win a world championship in order to prove that.
Yeah, he's just in the wrong team, always making the wrong choices at this point.
He's always blowing up his bloody
blowing
car.
Blowing up his engine.
Drinking champagne out of his own shoes.
You know?
And then he doesn't know why. Maybe that's the reason. Mistakes. Yeah. Exactly, George.
I wonder why. Because he's drinking out of his own shoe. Yeah. So, and then very lastly, Wandile, the demotion of Leclerc to P7 in Japan after a double post-race penalty.
Mm-hmm. Got a 5 second for crashing into Verstappen in the first turn. Fell to 16th and he raced his way back.
He did a good job.
Yeah,
he did a really
his
good
overtakes
job.
Overtakes were insane. Yeah. And then he got another 10 second because he wouldn't listen to the team and just go and get a new wing. And he got the 10 second, which I think is fair. He needs to stop being emotional. You've been calling this the entire season. He needs to stop being so emotional and just take advice from people who have years of experience.
Exactly. Don't think you're better than everybody else out the bat. Exactly. Yeah. You're not bigger than the team. I think that's a really good note to leave it on. Yeah. You know, it's not a one horse race. You're not bigger than the team. And
what if he did get fourth place, and then this happened? Mercedes wouldn't have won, but because this happened, it kind of threw everything. It was a sure win for Mercedes, and he could have been.
He could have been the one that blocked
for
it.
The team, yeah.
Exactly. So on that note, cheers, Wandile. Cheers, Martin. Cheers, Lawrence. Cheers. Hope you all have a really good week.
Oh, it's going to be a busy one.
Ciao.
Say that again. CliffCentral.com.